Hello, everyone. Thanks for being with us today. We are live on LinkedIn and YouTube. Today, we have a fantastic guest, Dr. Amir Faizpour, founder CEO of Aggregate Intellect. And today, I have with me also my friend, Dr. Benjamin Delsol. Maybe just a quick roundtable to present ourselves. Maybe we can start. Benjamin, can you just present yourself?
Yeah, in a nutshell, PhD in quantum physics, European patent attorney, IP strategist, and I'm enjoying a lot AI technologies.
Fantastic, Benjamin. Thanks for accepting to join me to interview.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Amir today. Hello, Amir. How are you?
I'm great. How about yourself?
Perfect. Thanks for accepting this live, because the subject is very interesting and will interest many people, particularly the law community. So you are an expert in large language models, artificial intelligence, and you are the founder, say, of Aggregate Intellect. What is Aggregate Intellect?
Definitely. Well, thanks for having me. I should give the disclaimer that I gave you earlier, that I don't know much about law, so I will be mostly talking about what I think will be the impact of, you know, large language models on the legal space based on my observations. Going back to Aggregate Intellect, so we run a very large community of AI researchers and engineers. And within that community, we've been, you know, running for a few years. We've been building this platform for knowledge management. Originally, the idea was to apply that to engineering disciplines, but in the past year or so, we have pivoted towards using it for optimizing various types of business workflows, including sales, marketing, and internal operations. We are a mostly bootstrapped company, so we also do a lot of AI advisory and implementation services for other startups primarily.
Fantastic. So you are, let's say, the expert to contact when a company needs to implement artificial intelligence, because now it's very hot and we can't bypass such disruption in the technology world.
Absolutely. I always try to ask a lot of questions, so I can at least ask you a lot of questions and help you think about it more in a more structured way, and hopefully I can also help you figure out the type of solutions you can look into.
Fantastic. And what type of company do you accompany? Big ones, startups, or what are your target?
Yeah, we are primarily interested in, there are two different parts of our commercial activities. There is the product side, and then there is the implementation services and advisory side. On implementation and advisory, I primarily work with the startups because they can move way faster. Ironically, right now I'm in conversation with several legal tech startups where I'm helping them with their AI strategy, with their data strategy, with how large language models can be leveraged in their workflows, customer facing, but also internal operations, as I said. So on the advisory and implementation side of things, mostly startups. On the product side of things, we are primarily interested in mid-market service, and more specifically, it seems that we are getting better traction in financial services type of medium-sized companies. Mm. So,
okay, but you are agnostic. I mean, if a design company knock at your door, you can help them. Okay, you don't have a specificity on the sector.
Absolutely. Like on the implementation side, we are very, very agnostic, as you say, to the sector for sure. We are also very agnostic to the data types. We are talking about large language models because that's the hot topic of the day. But in the past, we have done projects that involved image data, video data, time series data. So we like mostly because we are backed by a community of, you know, more than 5,000 AI researchers and engineers. Usually I know a guy or a gal who knows how to work with types of data, and I can pull them in to help with various types of projects. So we are very implementation and strategy services. We are very, very agnostic to data type. today's industry. But on the product side is where we are a lot more limited, or more focused rather, on large language models, business workflows, medium-sized companies in financial services.
Mm. Perfect. Thanks for this presentation of aggregated intellect. It was always fascinating to hear how you see this work and how you do it. As we are live today and dedicated to the lawyer community, maybe we will try to democratize a little bit our language also, to not to be too much technical. So maybe you could start by a little bit an introduction about what is this famous ChatGPT, why it is so impressive, and how it can impact the legal field. Just little introduction.
Yeah, when we get to the more legal side of things, I definitely want Benjamin to jump in and help me.
Don't worry.
Hi, everybody. But on the on the ChatGPT, I guess I can give a bit of a history of what happened. So AI has been around for probably many decades at this point. And by AI, I mean machines doing things that we traditionally call intelligent activities, right? Like detecting patterns in data, predicting what will happen in a stock market, etc. So different variations of that has been around. And the earlier types of AI systems, especially what we call machine learning, that got a lot more popular in early 2000s because of a few interesting frameworks that came out. A lot of them were focused traditionally on what we call structured data. The structured data is transactions, like CRM data, like data about the temperature on different days of the year, etc. These are data that are very structured, like every day you're getting the same type of data and storing them into a database. And we had a lot of different types of techniques and processes that we applied on these to detect different types of anomalies, predict the future, etc. And then in mid-2000s, we started doing the same type of techniques on unstructured data like images. So all of a sudden, we were able to apply AI on images and say, is this a dog or cat, or detect a cancerous gland in this picture, in this medical image, et cetera. That went on for a few years, and that was super hot. Like, everybody was very excited about it. Of course, there is another type of unstructured data that is text, which is capturing a lot of our knowledge, like textbooks, internet, et cetera. And we were interested on doing computation on this type of data as well. But the type of computation we could do on that data has been very limited, because normally we could count, how many times do words like this appear in this text, and therefore this is about politics, etc. So that was the type of analysis we were able to do on text before. Maybe this is early 2010. And then mid-2010, something very interesting happened. All of a sudden, we had developed this algorithm called Transformers that was able to take in a bunch of data and then analyze all of this data and predict a lot of interesting things about it, right? Like, that was the whole Transformer thing that I believe came out in 2015. And then BERT came out, which was a version of Transformers that was pretty exciting for people. People went absolutely nuts about it. They were like, oh my God, we can do all these crazy interesting things with text data now. And machine translation was around for a while, but all of a sudden at this point, machine translation started to become really good, like going from English to French became really good, and vice versa, etc., because of these new types of technologies we had access to. And then fast forward, these language models, BERT was the beginning of what we started calling language models. And language models are the type of models that essentially, you give it a bunch of text and they can model what language is like from a syntax, semantics, and other types of structures. And then GPT came out, I believe, in 20, Benjamin can probably help me, 2020, probably before 2020.
2023?
Well, the very first GPT was
2018
or 19 or something like that. Like, it was many, many years ago.
Yeah.
And that was very different than the GPT that we know as ChatGPT. But what I'm trying to say is that ChatGPT didn't come out of nowhere. Like, there has been this very gradual, slow, painful process of just adding blocks on top of blocks and slowly getting to the point where finally, I believe in 2021, we had GPT-3, which was a very powerful model. And, you know, a lot of us who are working in the field had access to this through APIs. We would call it and use it in a playground and play with it. So it was something that only nerds knew about. And then all of a sudden in 2022, you know, OpenAI, the company behind ChatGPT, made a few interesting decisions. One was they finally succeeded in getting these models to spit out things that are not that are high quality enough for a normal person to look at and say, huh, somebody has written it, right? Like, it became good to a level that it was hard to judge, is it from machine or not? So that was one important thing that happened, and we can talk about how they got to that through alignment with human preferences. But the second important decision that they made was that it's enough to feed the nerds, we should now go broader. So let's strap on a chat interface on top of this and allow people to chat with it, because now the quality is good enough that, you know, any, my grandma can talk to it and probably get something legible. So, and that was the very sort of step function change that we saw in the public perception, although the model itself was, you know, another block that was put on top of the mountain of blocks that it was.
It's fascinating. It's fascinating because we see now, you know, these amazing tools that is available for all of us, but we don't see all the hidden part of the iceberg, you know, that all the history and as you say, all the blocks that have been put on together and all the scientific work on that and engineers, etc. But we see just the result now, and it's fascinating. But it's how it is, you know. It's science. Usually, it's like that.
As always, yes.
So if I will try to think like a, you know, like I'm a lawyer but I'm not, of course. So we are not here to give any advice to anyone, but just to make a prospective discussion about how these tools can easier their life or even make their life a hell. Who knows? So how do you see the implementation of ChatGPT? But we talk about ChatGPT, but in fact, it's all other competitors too, you know, Gemini and now Mistral and also Claude. How to implement this into the legal field, maybe for legal research, document drafting, client communication, even client education, because it's very important. Most of the lawyers, you know, have this very jargonous way to explain things, but maybe now they can literally school, you know, their client.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, when GPT-3 came out, not GPT-3 and half, which is the back end of the original ChatGPT, when I think it was 21 that it came out, two fields picked this up and used them in products really well. One was marketing, because they were for the first time able to write very good copies for their websites and social media campaigns and things like that. A couple of platforms got absolutely popular. I think they reached like $1 million revenue within a year or something like that, like something really great, just because they very quickly figured out how to use these APIs to write very good copy. And the second one was legal field. And we can reserve our judgment of why people were so eager to figure out how to, you know, have machines do the legal work. But, you know, I think portion of it is because there is so much text involved in legal work.
Yeah.
Like, all the casework, there's all different types of judgments that are made. There's a lot of human judgment involved in interpretation of various things. But also there are a lot of things that are literally written as law. That you could go back and compare different cases, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, again, like, I'm not a lawyer and I don't know how lawyers work, but, you know, what I've heard is that lawyers usually have an army of people to help them with these types of research, like just going out and figuring out this clause says this and the interpretation might be this other thing and et cetera, right? Like, or the precedent for this thing was the case that happened. So there's a lot of that type of research that is like sit down and read all things and figure out what's related to what. And you can imagine there's a huge amount of human error involved. There's a human amount, there's a huge amount of sweat and tear and blood, but also there's a lot of human error. So, you know, we I'm sure for a sufficiently interested person, you can sit down and find many, many scenarios where, you know, an incorrect judgment was ruled because we didn't look at the right precedent, we didn't look at the right cases, case details and things like that. So a lot of people are very interested in figuring out, okay, how can machines do a slightly better job? And, you know, I know several companies that got really popular during that time, that they were essentially sitting on top of systems like GPT-3 and 3 and trying to do, you know, fast forward to this year, there are probably, you know, upwards of 100 globally, 500 globally, companies that are sitting on top of, you know, all of the language models that you mentioned, you know, the OpenAI models, Cloud, Mistral, et cetera, probably some of them for their use cases are completely fine to use third party. Some of them are optimizing for, you know, on-prem deployment with privacy and things like that, with the smaller open source models. So there's a lot going on in that space and that's really booming and I'm interested, you know, to observe from outside to see where it goes. But that's all, you know, building net new things with, you know, these types of technology. For, you know, even you and I, let alone lawyers, tools like ChatGPT, Gemini, all of these tools that have an interface is already a fantastic tool. Like I've been writing my own contracts by using just Gemini and ChatGPT, where I would go to it and say, hey, I'm trying to hire whatever, a fractional CTO, a developer, a marketing person. And I'm trying to, you know, give them these conditions, these terms, these situations, right? Yeah. What are some meaningful legal clauses I can use? ChatGPT writes it for me. And then I say something like, well, actually, there's this nuance. You know, they live in whatever city, so et cetera, et cetera. Can you rewrite it with that nuance now? And I do a bunch of back and forth, put it all in the document, send it to my lawyer and say, hey, lawyer, can you please take a look at this? Is this good enough? And the lawyer comes back with, oh, here is, you know, change this phrase to this. Did you actually mean this or not? So the amount of time that the lawyer had to spend is, you know, has dropped significantly to a fraction of the original time, right? So, and I'm not a lawyer. I have no idea what I'm doing. I'm just putting things in it. I just explain to it what I'm trying to do, which is originally what I would have done with my lawyer. I would have called him up and say, hey, I'm trying to do this, blah, blah, blah. Like I'm saving all of that time and money because I do that brainstorming with ChatGPT, copy paste it, send it to my lawyer and say, hey, you're a person who understands these things. Can you verify that what I did is right? Can you verify that there is no hallucination in this thing? So, and lawyers, I know lawyers, some of them are doing this too. Some of them are doing it very carelessly and they get caught in the court because it hallucinates a precedent. And then the judge is like, wait a minute, we didn't have that.
Yeah.
So, but it's a very interesting time. Like people at any level and any level of familiarity really with law are interacting with these artifacts. There are a lot of good questions that can be asked around ethics, responsibility, safety, and those things. But, you know, the fact is that we all are using it at some level.
You say two things that pop up in my mind. The first one is you know, when you send your contract to your lawyer, you know, the contract that GPT wrote for you, and the second point is that the lawyer has, you know, the good ego, you know, to not be offended by this interaction. I'm telling this on purpose because I see some lawyers in France who has been very offended, you know, by the coming of this GPT. You know, they are literally like you know, the taxi when Uber came in the business, you know.
Yeah.
And so so this is the first point. And the second point is also the pricing, because you cut a lot of time, you know, for the lawyer to write down a contract. So how was the pricing when you interacted in this way with your lawyer?
I mean, just to be clear, I'm not doing this only with my lawyer. I'm doing this with my accountant too, right? Like, with my, like there is this tax credit in Canada where we can claim some of the expense we had on research and development and get a portion of it back through a tax credit. I did that with them too. I said, look, guys, I know you usually write this report for us, but I don't think you need to do that this year. I'm just going to ChatGPT it and send it to you, and you review it, and you tell me, you know, what's right and what's wrong, right? So it is with all type of suppliers that I'm dealing with. And I want to point out two things. One is this was not the case. Like, I think my lawyer or accountant reaction would have been very different if I had gone to it and said, hey, I need a contract for a developer. Generate and then copy pasted that into a document and send it. Like, their reaction will be very, very different than what I did, which was I found a template online that was legit, like a template that somebody said, okay, this is a legit developer contract. Then I grabbed a bunch of clauses from it and I said, this clause is not what I want to say, right? And I then took that to ChatGPT and I said, this clause is this, but I wanted to say this other thing. So I spent like the, I don't know, 1 hour that the lawyer might have spent on this. Now I'm spending like 2 hours doing that curation myself. You know, it is not just copy-pasting a bunch of hallucinative things, right? Mm-hmm. So I'm just very carefully picking the parts and I'm saying, okay, this is good enough. I'm happy with this. But this one, I wanted to say something different. So that amount of work that I'm putting into it, hopefully lowers the level of offense or the level of, you know, defensiveness that the lawyer would have. If they see something that they read and be like, what is this ChatGPT, right? Like that would be a very, very different conversation. And the second thing is that I think getting defensive to some extent comes from an insecurity about what does this mean for my job? Like, a person that feels very strongly about, I give you an example. A few nights ago, I went to a concert, a small concert. And then we had a dinner with a few of the artists there. And one of my friends said, oh, Amir, and I said, I'm not an artist. I'm not into art, but I enjoy it. And my friend said, oh, he's here to figure out how to automate us. And I laughed and I made a face. And one of the artists had a very strong reaction to me. Like, he was like, don't even joke about it. That's not funny. Right. So a reaction like that is a very strong emotional reaction, and it comes from a position of, okay, what does this mean for me? Right. So there are people that feel that way, and that's completely valid, and we have to talk about it, have to have a conversation with them. But there are also people who have, to some extent, have had those conversations and probably started to understand that a lawyer with ChatGPT or equivalent is probably going to eat the lunch of the lawyer that is resisting them. So that's also an important distinction to be made.
Yes. And also, you did it smartly. I mean, you just don't just use ChatGPT. You spend time on it. You improve what it is delivering to you. So that's, I think, really important, because the risk is that people will just said, I need a contract for that. And they even don't go to their lawyer. They just send it to the future employee and stuff like that. And so this is really, really dangerous. But indeed, as you did it, it's perfect. And I think this is the most important thing we should tell to people. If you use ChatGPT to do whatever it is, which is normally done by another people, just ask them at the end if it's okay or not.
There's also the point of educating the client. You know, I know there is difference between the Latin law and the Anglo-Saxon law, civil versus common law. I never know which one is the English one, and the other one is the Latin one. But whatever, the Latin one is very complicated jargonous system, you know. If you are not a lawyer, it's very complicated, you know, to read a justice decision or any legal document. Do you believe that it's in the interest of the lawyer, you know, to educate, to democratize or popularize, you know, all these documents with the help of this artificial intelligence?
Oh, absolutely. That's one of the things that I do very commonly. Like, when somebody sends me a contract and I don't understand a clause of it, I copy paste it and I tell, you know, Gemini, what is this thing saying in human language?
Yeah.
I can plain English explain this to me. And then I ask follow-up questions like, you know, I don't know, like, okay, this is saying this, that my rights in this contract is A, B, and C, but doesn't mean that I can do whatever else. And of course, you know, I don't take the word, like I use these tools as another source of information. You know, I sort of brainstorm with it. I say, okay, explain this to me. And it does. And I say, okay, can I do, like it says that I'm allowed to do A, B, and C, and but D is kind of between C and B. Can I do that? And provides an answer. And I still use my own human judgment to decide, okay, is this valid or not? Like, I don't take it. You know, I might even like copy some phrases from the response on Google search and, you know, see if any reputable source has talked about it. What I like about Gemini is that you can ask it to validate the statements, right? Like it can say, okay, this statement is consistent with this resource. This statement, I didn't find anything for it, etc. Right? That's very valuable, and I use that a lot. So just knowing that, just using them as tools rather than, you know, I think you and I talked a little just sort of offline about AI as a judgment tool. AI is not a judgment. You as a human are the final judge. And AI is just feeding you slightly more curated amount of information that you should use.
Yeah, and yeah, just that makes me that reminds me Wikipedia. When I was in college, all professors said don't use Wikipedia as a source because we don't know if it's true, and so just stick to the books and so on. And few years later, during my PhD, everybody was using Wikipedia as a source. And without checking anything. And I think it will be the same with AI. I mean, right now you are checking everything. You are making your due diligence in a way. And okay, but I'm pretty sure that in 3-4 years, everybody will do it without checking. And because of course, in one side, AI will be more powerful. So that's good. But on the other side, it's because the brain like easy way. So I mean, it's okay. Why I will check everything if it seems okay, so it's good, and I will not pay my lawyer for 1 hour more to check it. And so again, I think we will drift in this direction because of people that I think that it's not people, it's the brain that want easy way.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that's a very important thing to think about, especially for us as the developers and product, because I put the burden of reducing that harm on the product. Like I had an LLM workshop a few days ago, and I asked one of my speakers if they think the fact that ChatGPT at the very bottom in very small font says, oh, by the way, this might make up things, just be careful. Like, is that a good product decision? In my opinion, that's a horrible product, because it is not enabling the user to prevent harm to themselves.
Yeah.
It is, just, and of course, you know, it says this is a research tool, blah, 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 all of those good things. But I don't think that's an excuse for that to stay the status quo for the past 18 months, right? Like, as a product person, I don't think I can sleep at night if I know my product might make up something and a lazy brain of an end user might decide to harm themselves with it, you know, as we're seeing all the lawsuits that are going on. So I think you're absolutely right. And as product people and developers, we have to acknowledge that and carefully design for the safety, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
Like OpenAI spent a lot of energy, and, you know, the equivalent models later spent a lot of energy on the so-called alignment of these models with human preferences. But the reality is that that's a small component, and I'm glad they did it. That's very important and necessary. But there are so many other things that are necessary to happen, and those have to happen around the model. Not like, for example, in our product, in Sherpa, we have modules, that we have built modules that check the numbers, check the entities in a response that Sherpa has given, check the sentences. And if a number that Sherpa is saying is not available in the original resources, the system automatically asks Sherpa to try again. It just gives it feedback and it says, hey, your response said $4,000, but I don't see $4,000 anywhere in the document. Can you double check? Can you try again?
Yeah.
And the second time it gets it right, surprisingly, right? You just have to think about places where things can go wrong and create guardrails. I think that's a very, very important thing.
So this is a model that you are developing right now at Aggregate. So it's your own proprietary model Okay, and you, what is your just a digression, you know, about this, because it's fascinating. And is it a B2B model, you know, or will it see it one day like ChatGPT and Gemini and others, you know, like every of this type of B2C models?
So just to be clear, I want to emphasize that we are not developing a new model, because, you know, there are a lot of smarter and more well-funded people who are doing that already. And I don't think the problems that I'm speaking about can be solved with better models. Hmm. I think the problems will be solved by better system designs around the models. Because even, like, you know, we have built around the OpenAI GPT models. And, you know, the GPT model itself, I don't know, has a 20-something percent performance on math. We get 99% out of the same model just because we did a smarter system design. We have added some components that take care of that property, right? So I think there is so much that you can do with just interfacing existing models with smaller models, with expert models, with, you know, delegating the right job to the large language model and the right job to the other models that exist. Like if I want, I don't know, to fact check, for example, that's another thing that Sherpa does. If the OpenAI API generates a bunch of text for me based on some documents I gave it, I want to be able to fact check. I want to fact check every single sentence and say, okay, this sentence is supported by the documents I had. This sentence is refuted by the documents I had, actually, et cetera, et cetera. But that can be done with a very small model. Like, I don't need to do anything with the OpenAI model. I can just train another model whose job is to be the adversary that says, this is right, this is refuted, and this I don't have an opinion
on. Yeah, exactly. You create a team of AI in a way. They just, it's like a squad. I mean, each AI have its own skills and they use it all together. Yeah.
Absolutely. That's a great way to put it.
You guys made a great transition, because I was thinking about, you know, in the law, when you have a case, you need to make a lot of research on past decision, and there are many logical things you have to find, that there are, you know, if there are paradox between different judgment, and many, many research, and it's based on the law logic, but the logic of the law is in fact a common logic, you know, that taught in philosophy course. How artificial intelligence can help the research team of the law, you know, to or even a PhD in a law to discover something?
Yeah, that's a great question. I don't know the answer for law, but I can tell you the general answer that I think applies to any scenario, right? So I go back to what I said earlier, which is, I think it's a very bad system design decision to put everything on the language model, because the language model, at the end of the day, is a language model. And what it is good at is natural language understanding, which means if there is an articulation from the user, it can understand, kind of, sort of, it can understand what it is saying pretty well. Not 100%, but pretty well. And natural language generation, which is it can write things that look legit, right? Mm. Like, that's all it can do.
Yeah.
It cannot do fact checking. It cannot do relevance checking. It cannot figure out what is niche and interesting. It cannot predict anything beyond just the next word, et cetera, et cetera. So all of these other things have to be built around it. And the way you would go about it is that, like, if I were asked to, you know, help a company do that, the very first thing that I would do is that I would say, bring in all your paralegal, bring in all your analysts, bring in everybody that does this job right now. Let's sit at a whiteboard and have them explain to me how they do it today. Mm. Like, they would say, okay, I go to Google and search for these terms, and then I open them in a tab, and this is how I judge if it is useful or not. Then I'll look for these type of phrases to, et cetera, et cetera. Then I copy paste them, then I rank them, then I blah, blah, blah. And I just build a system that replicates that exact workflow. You know, a system that specifically has an engine that interacts with Google search, interacts with their own internal documents, fetches the right paragraphs or whatever is the right granularities, fetches the right clauses, brings them up, ranks them. I don't know, let's say part of their workflow is also finding the meanings of some abbreviations that exist and, you know, inserting them. I'll build a system that does that, et cetera, et cetera. And all of these things will work with each other in the back end to carry out all the tasks that the analyst does. And then I strap the LLM on top of all of it, just to make the user experience easier.
Yes, exactly.
That's how I would go about it.
Yeah.
This is fascinating because I clearly see how all of this will impact research. By research, I mean academic research in law. And the job of the PhD in law, PhD student in law. maybe they won't need anymore to have PhD in law. Because,
oh, yes. No, you can, but you will do the PhD in 3 months.
Good life.
I think the roles will change, right? Like, if we transition the conversation a bit to, okay, what is the role of humans going forward? You know, so essentially, you know, as a PhD student back in the day, you know, a significant amount of my time was reading papers, interpreting them, wasting a lot of time reading 40 pages of paper because, you know, half a page of it was useful for me and I didn't know which half a page it was. It was, you know, a lot of setting up things in the lab and sitting down and writing code to analyze things, et cetera, et cetera. So imagine in my PhD, a lot of these things could have been delegated to a machine that takes care of my data analysis, takes care of, then I can spend more time coming up with theories, coming up with experiments I can try. Maybe by the end of my PhD, instead of, you know, and assuming that a PhD is 5 years or whatever, I know in Europe it is, what, 3 years, 4 years? Yeah. So by the end of N years of PhD, instead of having done 5 experiments, imagine that I would have done 120 experiments. Imagine the pace at which science could have made progress. Imagine at the, you know, tail end of my research, instead of having to sit down and deal with a bunch of reviewer number two that is, you know, giving me a bunch of crazy comments, my co-pilot would have just talked to their co-pilot and figured out all the things that need to be changed about the manuscript. Because at that point, it is just, a lot of it is just cosmetic change, right?
Yes, yes.
You know, there may be a few new experiments that I have to do, but then that's also easy because the co-pilot can tell me, hey, you know, reviewer two is making a good point about this. You know, maybe go to the lab. So imagine how much time would have been saved. Imagine how much faster science would
be. Yeah, I'm okay with you, but this is on, I'm absolutely okay with you. And 10 years ago, when I was thinking about AI and looking what was doing and so on, I was thinking that with AI, every painful task can be done, and it will make rooms for creativity, more creativity and so on. But what I have seen when ChatGPT has come, and when also all the models to create images was available to everybody, is that there is more room for creativity, but we don't use it. Instead, we use AI to create things instead of using our free time to create things. And it was quite, not shocked, but a little bit, because the first use case at the end was create songs, poems, to create images, pictures. And it was exactly what I was thinking, that we will have more time to do it without AI. So I'm okay with you. We should have more time to do more experiments. But I'm afraid that, again, the laziness will take over. And instead of that, we probably will be spending more time on social networks. And again, it's a question of discipline. I often compare AI with all the apps for delivery food.
Mm.
Yeah, you can deliver. Of course, you can ask for very good food. It's possible. But what does people do? No, it's not that. They are in their sofa, looking craps on TV and asking for junk food.
McDonald's.
Yeah, I don't say it. But and that's it. So, and again, they should have more time for readings, for playing with their kids instead of cooking. But at the end, they don't. So it will request for our side more discipline again.
So I love that you brought this up, and I wish we had like 10 more hours to talk about it, because you just opened the can of war.
Yeah, I know.
I do actually have an article that is coming out this week on the topic of what is necessary for the automation to actually make a meaningful impact. Mm-hmm. And the conclusion of that article that I wrote is you cannot, like, it is very much like self-driving cars, right? Like, you cannot expect self-driving car to be the norm until we do significant changes in how our cities are built, how our infrastructure is built, how we think about moving around, how a lot of other things adapt to that reality, right? Because imagine that you have the best self-driving cars, but the roads are what they are. The traffic signs are what they are. The rest of the people are driving the way they are, right? Like, the use is going to be minimal. Now, let's take a step back and think about work automation through AI. You're absolutely right that it is opening up the bandwidths of the people to do more, create more, spend more time on meaningful things. But they're so brain dead from their 9-to-5 job that they take any dopamine hit to just be away from it, right? So we have to go back and rethink, is the 9-to-5 type of corporate structure the right way to do, right? Or maybe there's a different way. Or maybe there is another infrastructure change that needs to happen. Maybe universal basic income is necessary. Yeah. I don't know what the solution is, but I know that there are a lot of infrastructure that exists right now that is based on the assumption that the humans are doing mundane work. Yeah. So if we can remove that assumption and reimagine the infrastructure and think, okay, what infrastructure is needed for us to be able to, like, I spend a lot of time thinking about post-work meaning. Like, what is even meaning going to be if people don't have work the way that it is defined today, right? Yeah. Like, and what kind of infrastructure is necessary for people to adapt to them?
No, that's a good point. And for the self-driving car, from my point of view, when everybody will have a self-driving car, I mean, when all the cars are self-driving cars, okay, no more problem. So, but as you said, if it's only one person, it doesn't work. And for your point of view about changing the infrastructure of the working force, it's indeed very, very clever. Yeah.
So, guys, we talk about you know, how artificial intelligence can help a lawyer to read a lot of document for their research. But it can also help lawyers to educate and communicate in a better way with their client. We can talk about a little bit about the automatization of how lawyer can stay up to date, you know, because, for example, in the Latin world, we have a continuous flow of law that is emitted by the legislator. In the Anglo-Saxon world, you have not only the legislator, but you have also a lot of jurisprudence, I don't know how can I pronounce it well or not, by different states, you know, and it make the work of the lawyer firm a hell, you know. So the artificial intelligence can help them, you know, to have this this information up to date and popping up, you know, when they have a case and say, hey, be careful, there is a jurisprudence there, or there is a new law. Do you think that it's a possibility?
Oh, absolutely. I think one of the things, I was actually writing a grant proposal this morning about a topic that is kind of tangential on what you're describing, which is one of the areas that I'm personally very excited about is how technologies like this will enable more effective human-human communication, right? Like, if I have, if I'm in a legal situation and I need to hire a lawyer, I assume that because I don't know how to use the right language, I waste a significant amount of time just trying to explain what my situation is. Now, imagine a scenario where I talk to my co-pilot and say, hey, this is my situation. Here's a bunch of data related to it. Here's a bunch of emails related to it. Crunch all of this and tell me how to communicate this most effectively to my lawyer. You can literally do that with ChatGPT or systems like that.
Yes.
Right? And then copy by paste that into an email and send it to the lawyer. You know, two steps further ahead. In the future, imagine that I can do that and then my co-pilot talks to the co-pilot of the lawyer. They, you know, do the things, and then we meet, and on a 5-minute call, I'll be like, okay, do you have any questions for me? They're like, yeah, okay, so this little area is unclear to me, you know, can you just give me more details? And I explained it, and he's like, okay, great. 95% was there. This 5% is adjusted. Good to go. Let's go. Right. So I think that's huge. And, you know, what lawyer can do on their side is to, you know, set up their co-pilot to be an educative type of system, right? A system that provides feedback, a system that asks the right questions. For my system, for my legal co-pilot to be one that is capable of translating plain English into, you know, jargon, you know, full, you know, legal text to talk to the, you know, like, I see a lot of opportunity. I don't know how much value there is in educating people for sake of educating people, because at least in my circle, I haven't seen people who just read, you know, legal documents for fun. But, you know, for very purposeful scenarios where, okay, there is a thing, I have a dispute with my landlord, I'm trying to figure out how to navigate it. I don't want to sit down and read Reddit, you know, threads and internet random pages and, you know, figure out, is this just the SEO page or is it actual useful information, et cetera, right? Like, I just want to talk the way I would talk to a friend, to an agent, to an AI system that tells me, okay, these are things you have to think about. These are things you can articulate, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, but so I'm okay with you and it's perfect. I think in 2, 3, 4 years, but I think in 10 years, you don't need anymore the lawyer because you have only copilot. I mean, your agent will talk to another agent, which will be certified by the US government, for example, and that's it. And you don't have to think about it. And I hope we will have, as you said, more time for creativity because the infrastructure of the work will change. And I hope that otherwise it's, the dark side will be the matrix. I mean, we are connected. We will be able to play everything we want, to enjoy virtual worlds if we want. But at the end, all the economy, I would say, will be completely managed by AI. Like in the matrix, it's not economy, it's energy, but more or less it's the same. So
it's our Wally.
Oh, yes, Wally. Yeah, well, Wally, yeah, it's also a dark side. but I think, yeah, just I will have to leave in 5 minutes, sorry. But just, I think you're right.
Benjamin, I cut you because I have a great question and I want you to hear it because okay. It's concerned what you do. The very important question that it remains for us is the cybersecurity and data privacy for a lawyer. Can I upload the sensitive data of my client on ChatGPT, Gemini, and so on, and have the trust that this data on their server is fully safe?
Just 2 seconds. It's not only safe. I'm in the patent field. So on my side, I would say it's not only a question of safety. It's a question of accessible to the public. Is it a disclosure or not of the information? So
and by the NSA. Also.
Yeah, if you want. but I mean, it's not only safety. There is a safety question, but there is also the confidentiality question. Mm. And I think safety, and you will be telling us perfectly, I think it's great, but the confidentiality, I think it's a bit tricky.
What's your thoughts, Amir?
Yeah, I definitely agree. I personally do not put any information that I don't want to be seen in the public. Like, that's how I treat it. Like, if there is a piece of information that I wouldn't post on, you know, my LinkedIn that is public, I would not put it in ChatGPT. Like, if I want to, like, part of the reason that I do that process that I described, that I copy paste to specific places and say, hey, rewrite this, say this differently, explain this, etc., is that then I can control what exactly I'm putting there. Sometimes, you know, if there are names of people, and I think the name is important for the rewriting, I might, you know, for example, replace Ari's name with saying, you know, I don't know, a man's name or whatever, or John, you know, John Smith or whatever. So you could do, and that's what we would do with custom builds as well. Like in custom build, when there is a concern around privately, personally identifiable information, confidentiality, privacy, we always put in layers that remove this kind of information or replace them with like animal names. I'm making that up, but you know, something that is not relevant to that particular person. And that's a very tricky question from many layers, because if you know where I live, if you know what I do, if you know you know, where I hang out, but you don't know my name, it's like 3 seconds to find what my name is, right?
Yeah.
There are also those correlations that you have to be careful with. So you have to think about, okay, what are all the things that might give away who somebody is,
yeah,
and just replace all of that information.
So I think it's our duty to educate people on that, because we are thinking about it, so we are cautioned, we take cautions, but I think most of the people don't think about it. Even in Samsung, for example, when they the developers on Samsung were using ChatGPT for coding, they was not aware of this, for example.
Benjamin, I know that you have another
thank you very much, Shamir. It was great seeing you again. Very interesting discussion. And as you said, if we have 10 hours more, it could be great, because this is a huge, huge, huge subject. So thank you both of you. Thank you, Harry, for having me again. And see you soon.
Good meeting. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Thanks.
Cheers, Andrew.
Amir, I have maybe one or two more questions, then I will let you go. Let's talk about something a little bit more light. In the present, how do you see the new type of job that can emerge and be being hired by the law firm? Prompt engineer or AI expert, or I don't know, what is the title you think that will emerge in the coming years?
Yeah, definitely. I think less than new titles that would emerge in legal field, I think, or you know, that's really my one person opinion or guess, is that we will see more marriage between technical fields and legal field, because you know, more traditionally they were to some extent separated, you know, except for, you know, I don't think would hire lawyer like corporate lawyers and things like that. I think we're going to start seeing the opposite flow as well, that a lot of tech people would go towards, you know, legal companies and you know, work with them. As I said, like I'm personally involved in a few different legal tech startups, and I know nothing about tech, but I know things that they're trying to use now. You know, like I'm helping them with, as you said, prompt engineering, with designing custom systems, with figuring out how to build these types of technologies with guardrails and security and safety into their existing, you know, platforms and software that they use. So I think we are going to see a lot more marriage of these fields. And I think, you know, what I said earlier, that is, you know, a lawyer powered by these co-pilots is probably going to eat the lunch of the lawyers who are resistant to it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what's going to happen. Like, you know, more of us will essentially show up in those areas.
And in terms of education, do you think that the law college will integrate, some IT course or computer science course, or the opposite, the computer science course will offer law course or something like that?
I mean, given that, you know, computer science related fields have a history of just finding themselves in all of other sectors, I think if I were to guess, that's probably what is going to continue to happen, where, you know, people with IT capabilities will find themselves into other areas. And, you know, I'm assuming that, you know, very much like, I don't know, political science, you know, academic departments at some point started teaching their students, you know, R, the programming, the statistical programming language, because that was a tool that they were using to do their job. I think the same thing is going to happen. Like, if these types of technologies become commonplace and reliable enough that becomes part of the toolbox of the academic research, then, you know, it is expected for people to pick those up and, you know, teach them as well to be used properly and safely.
Great. So this is reminds me, you know, the growth hacker in the marketing field who are engineer by training, who moved into the marketing field, and they made a lot of progress. They helped the marketing to make a lot of progress. So it's exactly the same thing. I mean, just to conclude, first of all, thank you so much for being my guest for 1 hour. It was always fantastic to have you, because you are such a great expert and such a great communicator, you know, how to transfer this information in an easy way. I understand everything, so thank you. Just maybe to conclude, first of all, what is the next step for Aggregate Intellect? What you are doing and what you are What is your update and event you are organizing right now?
Yeah, definitely. Just to, you know, comment on what you said earlier also, you know, I think where we are going is a society where work is a lot more fluid. People jump around a lot more. They, you know, work with interesting projects regardless of where that interesting project is. And, you know, I do encourage your audience to think about it that way, you know, start reducing the amount of I'm a lawyer, I shouldn't interact with technology, and probably increase the rate of, you know, who are the interesting technology people I can surround myself with? Because, you know, with that osmosis, you're going to start picking up a few things that might hopefully end up being useful. And that's, you know, and I'm using that as a segue to, you know, what my priority is these days. You know, as I'm getting a lot of inbound from people who are trying to wrap their heads around it, and I'm, you know, doing this sort of a fractional chief AI officer type of engagement with a lot of startups, that's exactly what I'm trying to do, you know, like just show up, help them make good decisions, help them figure out what kind of, there's also so much noise out there. So, you know, help them figure out what to pay attention to, what they can safely ignore for now. So that's really what I'm up to, trying to figure out what other companies and projects I can get involved in. And as I said, like, you know, I'm spending maybe a few hours a week on each of these projects, but hopefully the teams are getting a lot of value by mostly me saying, don't worry about these things, you can come back to them later, but these are the more important things to pay attention to. So that's definitely my priority, to find more interesting projects like that. And in terms of events, we have weekly events, we have monthly events, we have so many events. I will share my our event calendar link, and hopefully you can add it to the show notes.
Fantastic. I will, of course, add all your links in the replay and the description of the video. Thank you so much for being my guest. It was a great honor to have you. See you soon. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Ari.